Airstream, the online art magazine. This is Adobe Airstream Radio. Art, film, music, design.
Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Accomplished faculty who understand what it means to live the life of an artist. Creative students. Hands-on learning in a vibrant city for culture. See us on the web at santafeuniversity.edu. Santa Fe University of Art and Design, where creativity is our business.
On Saturday, July 14th, the Santa Fe Opera House erupted with standing ovations at the conclusion of a new kind of world premiere, a premiere of the new critical edition of Rossini's Maometto II, an opera that had its very first performance in Naples, Italy in 1820. While it is 190 years later, this three-hour opera appeared not only incredibly fresh in its singing, its staging, and its music, but contemporary in its themes. Cheers of brava and bravo went up for soprano Lea Crocetto singing Anna and bass baritone Luca Pisaroni as Maometto II, the Turkish sultan and would-be conqueror of Italy with whom Anna shares a doomed love. Here with us today is Philip Gossett, foremost international musicologist, world authority on 19th century Italian opera, and the general editor of the series in which this new critical edition of Maometto II will appear. Philip Gossett, thank you for being here.
I'm delighted to be here with you.
What went right last night in the debut at Santa Fe Opera of Maometto II?
I think most things went right. The most important thing is that the Santa Fe had put together four wonderful singers for the most important parts. This is an opera that depends upon having a great bass, a great soprano, a great tenor, and a great mezzo-soprano. And unless you have all four able to do it, you can't really perform this work. But they did have it, and that was a remarkable event as a result. I think that they did a magnificent job of making the opera come alive. And this is not an easy opera to do because, as you heard last night, there is a great deal of music in it, so much music, in fact, that in a way the audience can almost become tired by the amount of beautiful music being thrown at them during the course of the evening and the music that they've never heard before. You know, at almost any point within the work, there are unusual things that happen in the vocal lines or in the orchestra, and you have to be sensitive to them. When, at the end, she sings to her mother, for example, Anna sings to the death, to the tomb of her mother, she sings a melody that goes D, C sharp, A, C natural, B, G. She's got to be sure that you hear that C sharp and C natural. They are very unusual sounds. Nobody did anything like that. Even when the whole thing comes to an end, you think the opera is concluding, and the chorus sings, O giorno di dolore, a terrible day of sadness, and the piece comes to a close on E major. But at a certain point, Rossini does, in the orchestra, he has a scale going up on E major, and then goes down a scale on F major, over an E pedal. Now that's an effect that's enormously unusual that I don't know of any example of it anywhere else in Italian opera of the period or later, and yet it is so effective.
Help us understand your role as the musicologist and the series editor in building, in a way, the foundation of a successful theater piece and opera like this one. What do you do?
Well, I've done several different things for this company. For example, I wrote a series of ornaments for the entire opera. Now, I didn't suggest that they had to do just that. In Rossini, sometimes you see a thing that looks the same as when it's repeated, but it's not meant to be the same because singers were expected to revise the music when it was sung a second time. So I suggested to everybody what they might do, and then I was here during the first 10 days of the rehearsal period to listen to what they were actually doing, because, of course, in some cases I knew their voices well, in some cases I didn't know them, individually, and so I was able to listen to what they were doing and suggest where I thought they had made mistakes and where they were just right on target in terms of the style. I also learned a great deal. I was able to tell the conductor and the stage director where they worked very well and where there were problems about what they were doing. There was, for example, a desire on the part of some of them to cut some of the recitative. That was fine. I had no objection to them cutting some recitative, but they could not cut all references to the place where Anna gives the signet ring of Maometto to her father, because without that you can't understand the plot. You needed that information in order to understand what happens in the opera.
Let's talk a bit about that and the contemporaneity of the storyline, because in a very early line we hear Maometto and his army described as bringing fire and death. And so we, of course, had the politics that were contemporary in Italy in the 19th century. And yet, in the end, this story has a romantic heroine, a female Western martyr who dies for country.
That's right. It does have that. But you have to remember that the story of the Turks fighting against the Europeans was very much relevant in the beginning of the 19th century, as well as in the 15th century. So when David Alden and his stage designer decided to bring the costumes into the 19th century, what they were doing was essentially creating a situation in which you would understand this group of Venetians fighting against the Turks as being related to the moment in which Byron was killed, you know, was drowned off the shores of Greece in the 1820s. And that's the period in which, in a sense, the opera was moved. But the story is timeless because it's a story about love and duty.
So Lea Crocetto's part as Anna last night has had some illustrious forebears, has it not, including Beverly Sills at the Met? Speak a little bit about this opera and its various...
Beverly Sills at the Met sang in a different piece. She sang a piece called Le Siège de Corinthe. But what they did at the Met was, in a way, a scandal, because what they did was put together a little bit of three operas and pretend that it was an opera that Rossini wrote. But it wasn't an opera that Rossini wrote. Beverly Sills had a great success in this constructed opera, but the result was that nobody performed Maometto II for 40, 50 years after Beverly Sills did this, because although she had a great personal success, Rossini had a disastrous evening at the Met. This happened also when Beverly Sills the next year performed Rossini's Turk in Italy at the New York City Opera. And what she did there too was to take a serious aria at the end of the opera and turn it into a fake mad scene, at the end of which she lifted her head up and winked at the audience. I was there, so I saw this. I know that she did it. The audience loved her, of course, and they had wonderful time with Beverly Sills. But the Turk in Italy disappeared from the stage for almost 50 years as a result, because nobody was willing to do an opera that was understood to be for Beverly Sills in this way. Whereas Rossini's own opera was able to be performed recently beautifully in Los Angeles and elsewhere very successfully, because they took seriously what Rossini had written, which was not what Beverly Sills did.
So you've conducted rather a forensics of this opera, it sounds like. Can you address that a bit?
I have certainly looked at all the sources for this opera, and I know what Rossini did and when. So, for example, we know that he wrote Maometto II in 1820 for Naples. It was not terribly successful in Naples, because the audience found it too difficult in many respects. He then rewrote it in 1822 for Venice. We feel that what he did in 1822 was not acceptable. because what he did was to take out all of the things that were characteristic of the 1820 version. And then he rewrote it yet again in Paris in 1826, returning in some respects to the original, but in other respects doing new things. We are printing the opera in its two Italian versions, the 1820 Naples version and the 1822 Venetian version, and we are performing here the 1820 Naples version. We will ultimately also print the 1826 French version, but that's going to be a separate volume.
So several things were very striking last night, speaking as an audience member, and they included the outstanding music and orchestra, but also the size of choruses who stayed on stage for long periods, and there were repeated phrases, almost as if the choruses were witnessing actions that constellated around these principles. Can you speak to the opera structurally and the music that you alluded to at the beginning of our conversation as being difficult?
Certainly I can. Rossini writes several choruses that are complete pieces, but he also writes places in which the chorus has to participate within the recitative. And you have to listen to those choruses and hear them as full choral numbers, taken very seriously by the people who are participating and by the audience, so that the choral role is very unusual throughout the opera, and Rossini was very sensitive to the way that the chorus would be heard throughout this opera.
Is there something special in this particular opera, which sounds like it's had quite a storied history in the way it continues to reveal the human condition to ourselves, the conflict again between country and love, which is something that, again, in this case, a female heroine dies for her country?
I think that we react to it as today very positively because we understand what it means for someone to have this be pulled apart by love on the one hand and a sense of duty on the other hand. And remember that at the beginning of the second act, the chorus sings, "E follia." It's a folly for someone not to give in to love. But Anna refuses to give in to her love because she feels that she, in doing so, she has been unfaithful to her people. And that matters a great deal to her.
So are you optimistic about the success of 19th century Italian opera delivered in new productions like this one?
I think that I was a little bit uncertain what would happen about this Maometto at Santa Fe, and I must admit I was delighted by the reaction of the public last night, because it is a complicated and difficult opera to do. There is so much beautiful music. It never stops coming at you. There is music everywhere, but the trouble is a great deal of the music is slow, and one has to be willing to follow Rossini's details in order to appreciate it effectively. But I was very, very positively impressed by the audience and the way that they reacted to it. I hope that the opera will continue to have that kind of success among opera goers.
Philip Gossett, thank you so much.
My pleasure, really it is. Thank you.
Future performances of Maometto II at Santa Fe Opera can be seen on July 18th, July 27th, August 2nd, August 7th, and August 16th. For tickets and more information, visit www.santafeopera.org. For Adobe Airstream Radio, I'm Ellen Berkovich.
Up next, from Adobe Airstream contributor Don Simpson, our Austin music feature. Back when Don first talked with Grace London, she was the 11-year-old lead vocalist of Residual Kid. He says he still recalls being blown away by the maturity, intelligence, and profundity of London's responses to his interview questions, but most of all, to her commitment to using her modest success to help the less fortunate around the world.
London left Residual Kid shortly after Don's interview in order to pursue a solo career. Considering all of the positive press that Residual Kid was generating at the time, he says he wasn't sure it was the best move on London's part, but after becoming madly addicted to the five tracks on the now 12-year-old's first solo EP called Rocket Ship Girl, he says he has no doubts that London made the right move. Here's Don Simpson's favorite track from London's Rocket Ship Girl, Eloise.
I rode my bike past Lady Bird Lake when I saw something in the water. What could it be in this place so cherry sweet? I must be dreaming, it's such a lovely day. I saw Eloise floating in. Eyes were gone, gone, gone. Her pretty satin bows drifted along with her blonde hair. There was a smile on her face, but there was nothing there.
Eloise then proceeded to walk out of the water and disappeared.
Yay. For more information on Grace London, check out gracelondonmusic.com.
Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Accomplished faculty who truly understand the spark, the moment, the decision to become an artist.
There was something about being an artist and dealing with the unknown all the time and putting yourself out there that it was a physical activity and an intellectual activity, and that's when I decided I wanted to be an artist.
They've experienced firsthand how an artist's career can unfold spontaneously.
I had been working for various local newspapers, and then I began working for some national magazines, and I had joined an agency. And at one point along the line, I realized I was doing my work. I was doing photography work. I was doing editorial work. It was quite satisfying, quite wonderful.
They grasped the power of legacy and identity.
Smoke Signals has made my whole career. It came out 14 years ago, and it's still the movie that I'm best remembered by.
They've navigated the intersection of commercial and artistic success.
My newest book is called Sky Burial. It came out in 2011. It's done amazingly well. It got reviewed in the New Yorker in the summer in a big review. That was pretty exciting. It was listed as a best book of poetry through the San Francisco Chronicle, the New Yorker, and Library Journal. So it's been amazingly gratifying.
They know sometimes the most unlikely events can launch an art career.
Probably the first project that was the one that began it all was a project on drugs and prostitution in Washington, D.C. and New York City. And I spent about 4 or 5 months, lived on the streets part of that time, and that's when it happened.
They know that a project born in a dream can lead to a spectacular outcome.
Smoke Signals was something that I dreamt to make in 1993. It was based on a collection of short stories. The movie was made and distributed by Miramax, and I traveled the world doing film festivals. Matt Damon and Winona Ryder and Harvey Weinstein were at the premiere. What it's done for me is it still the thing that people most remember me by?
They know that as an artist, you have to seize the moment.
I was in New York in my early 30s. At one exhibition in particular at Art in General, it was called Constructive Paintings, a stranger came up to me, one of the attendees of the exhibition, and she said to me, you know, I so look forward to seeing your work. I look for your name in the paper to see if you're having shows, and I anticipate your shows because I am really always curious to see what you'll be doing with your work.
A riff on the unexpected.
My best friend on the street when I was working on a documentary project on drugs and prostitution, his name was Angelo Boone, and he was a junkie. And I remember we were in an oil house, and he said to me, Tony, you keep taking these pictures. You keep taking these pictures. So you can show the kids what doing drugs is really about.
As teachers, they have the power to transform the lives of their students.
When I was in college, as an undergraduate, I studied with a Czech poet named Miroslav Halov. He took me into his office one day and he said, you are a poet. And then he said, you have an absolute responsibility with this gift. Don't sit in a cafe all day with a beret on your head, writing about sitting in a cafe with a beret on your head.
They've learned the joy of creation is rooted in generosity.
As photographers, we take, and I think it's always important to try to give something back.
Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Accomplished faculty who understand what it means to live the life of an artist. Creative students. Hands-on learning in a vibrant city for culture. See us on the web at santafeuniversity.edu. Santa Fe University of Art and Design, where creativity is our business.
I'm David Darcy for Adobe Airstream Radio. Tiger Eyes is the first film of a book by the author Judy Blume to be adapted for the screen. The director is Larry Blume, the author's son, who collaborated with his mother on the script. Here's the story in case you haven't read the book. Davis Davy Wexler and her family are fleeing Atlantic City after Davy's father's killed in the robbery of a 7-Eleven where he works. Judy Blume comes from Elizabeth, New Jersey, and this is something of an homage to her roots. She also suffered the sudden death of her father. Davy and company settled in Los Alamos, New Mexico, another reference to Blume's biography. She lived in Los Alamos with her children, and she met her current husband in Santa Fe. Once in New Mexico, Davy encounters lots of spoiled kids. But she also meets a local guy, Wolf, played by Tatanka Means, whose father, Willie, played by Russell Means, is dying. It's a mix of that tragedy and the majesty of the landscape that shows the girl that the world is bigger than any single person's tragedy. Another way to describe that experience is to call it coming of age, not a bad lesson for any young person. The discovery in this film is in the cast, and thanks to production incentives from the state of New Mexico. Willa Holland finds an effective mix of volatility and vulnerability in Davy, her teenaged character. Tatanka Means is a young man with roots, without hammering this too hard. Lucian Dale, as Davy's brother Jason, is that rare character, a kid who's not too cute on screen. We'll be seeing more from all of them, and more of Judy Blume's books in the movies. For Adobe Airstream Radio, I'm David Darcy.
You've been listening to Adobe Airstream Radio, the voice of Adobe Airstream Online. Music for Adobe Airstream Radio, Freedom, featuring Snowflake, by Eshar, courtesy of ccmixter.org, under a Creative Commons license.
I awake to my freedom. Give it birth from within.
Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Accomplished faculty who understand what it means to live the life of an artist. Creative students. Hands-on learning in a vibrant city for culture. See us on the web at santafeuniversity.edu. Santa Fe University of Art and Design, where creativity is our business.